Welcome to Overcrest. I'm Chris.
And I'm Jake.
And the gambling continues. Another gamble.
That's
of an episode.
Right.
This one's less of a gamble. This
Do you think
less
so?
Of a gamble.
Well,
we have an expert now.
So if you joined us last week, we talked about kind of the interesting, storied, colorful history of motorsport in Las Vegas and Formula One with the racetracks there and how they were complete and utter failures. And I alluded to the fact that, of course, that we found an author who is kind of the singular source. He is the expert on all things racetracks and motorsport in Las Vegas. He has two books. He is the Caesar's Palace Grand Prix, which is, of course, Las Vegas Organized Crime and the Pinnacle of Motorsport, as well as the book The Stardust International Raceway, which is Motorsports Meets the Mob in Vegas. He is Randy Cannon, and he's going to be joining us here in a minute to basically tell us.
I'll put the links to the books in the show notes.
Yeah,
too,
we'll have to do that in the show notes so you can check them out. I'm excited to hear how wrong I was, because I always like to say, you know, this is for entertainment purposes only. This is not a book report, Chris. I do my best.
Is that a cop out?
Yes, that 100% is. Yes, it is. No, and I've told you, like, it's a lot of work checking my sources and double checking, because as we know, you can read one story online and then you go somewhere else and you go, actually, that didn't happen. And here's what did happen. So
right. It's
a lot of work. But I always claim that, you know, this is for entertainment, guys. So, yes, I'm excited to hear, how wrong I was, because he, to my horror, did listen to our episode last week, which will be exciting to hear what he thought.
Yeah.
And it sounds like he has a lot of interesting anecdotes and behind the scenes. I want to know.
I want to know more mob stuff. That's all
exactly.
I know. And both of his books say have mob in the title.
Exactly. So it's got to be good, right? So before we get into the interview, though, Chris, probably should talk about our favorite sponsor. Well, I shouldn't say that. I shouldn't say favorite, how about this? Our favorite subscription service sponsor.
There you go.
It is, of course, Petrol Box. Petrol Box, made just for automotive enthusiasts. Great gift as well. Each month they deliver lots of goodies, the greatest gear in the industry. You have garage gear, publications, you have apparel, you have tools, detailing supplies, and every month they land right there on your doorstep for as little as $19.95 a month for the Petrol Box Basic. What?
Jake, I've got my tool.
Oh, yes.
This is my my Petrol Box tool this week. These are nice, and this is great because mine are trashed. I have a set of these, like a channel lock version of one of these. And,
We got some good electrical wire cutters and crimpers.
They're spring loaded, which is nice.
And it has the safety lock there. I know it very much. That went right into my toolbox.
Absolutely. I've already used it. It was sitting on top of my toolbox. I've already used it.
There you go. You know what's funny? I totally forgot I even had that because I was stripping a wire, and I just used my knife to do it. And
Jake.
No, you don't. Right there. Quality tools. It's cool what you get in there. Also got some soap, some car soap, which was out.
I'm also out. That's great.
It is car cleaning season now. Finally.
I know. I have the Griot's like lather it up sprayer thing, whatever it's called. I don't even know what it's called. Hook it up to the
foam
water.
Cannon.
Foam cannon. That's it. I got a Griot's foam cannon, and I filled it up with soap, and then because it was slippery, soap is slippery, it slipped out of my hand and all poured out onto the ground.
Oh, no.
So that was all of my soap. So I'm like, okay, well, so I just put like a little bit of like shitty soap in there that I had, like the last little dregs of it went in there. So this is good timing. Somehow they always have this great timing with what arrives.
I agree. Yeah, it's really good. They also, like for the last probably almost year now, you get cool, unique enamel pins every single month.
Yes. Yep.
Really cool.
Absolutely.
So high quality stuff, as little as $19.95 a month. You can get even more gear for $39.95 a month for the Petrol Box Premium. And of course, check them out. MyPetrolBox.com. You can use the code Overcrest. That'll get you discount on your first order.
Okay. So I have a confession to make before we
tell me your guest. Confession.
Actually, it's a little bit your fault.
Uh-oh.
We say we're going to offer exclusive content to the Drivers Club.
Ah, yes.
And we haven't the last couple months, and I feel bad. We skipped a couple months. We skipped some time.
We did.
I just want to know, can we get back on schedule with that?
100%.
100%.
Yeah, you're right.
We're going to get back on schedule with the exclusive content. It was a little bit hectic. What was hectic, honestly, was putting together those 9/11 episodes. Was like so much work. I mean, putting those together was an incredible amount of work.
We've
set us back time-wise a little bit. and we've been working on that. But I really want to emphasize that we're going to start doing the exclusive content again. So if you want to hear that stuff, and there's already like a huge library of, I don't know, probably 30 episodes now.
Yeah, we have a big back catalog.
Back catalog, really cool. Of exclusive stuff that's not available anywhere else. It's more of a casual us, too. It's not.
Yeah,
it's
I would
not
say we
so
take
polished.
It a little more. Yeah, it's behind the scenes, guys.
Behind the scenes, guys. Plus, you can get access, early access to merch with I think we give a little bit of a discount on it as well. Give a discount on merch, give a discount on rally tickets.
Early access,
that stuff. You can get a t-shirt if you're, you know, you sign up enough, you get a print from me, all kinds of different things. Not just the exclusive content. Plus, you get to feel warm and fuzzy on the inside, which is always the place where you want to feel warm and fuzzy. And if you don't do it, you won't feel warm and fuzzy at all, which means you feel awful. So if you don't sign up,
wow,
you're an awful person.
So if you want to feel not awful, head over to Drivers Club. Chris, I'll give you a little sneak peek. I have an entire list. Speaking of our exclusive episodes, I have an entire list of potential topics to do.
Okay.
Do you want to tell me what you want to hear? I'm gonna just list off.
Okay.
A few
go through
items
and I'll tell you what I want. What we're gonna do next? I'll pick it up.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Yep. Okay. So we got Ivan Hirsch. He happened to be the British military officer who successfully launched Volkswagen after World War II. That might be a longer one. Mm-hmm. We have Roger Rager, who he used a actual school bus engine in a successful Indy car.
Okay, sounds good.
We have cyclist Jean-Claude Rude and the 935. You've probably seen the photo.
Seen that. I'd love to. Actually, I would really like to hear that story.
You want to hear
seen
that
picture
one.
A million times. I want to hear that one.
But you don't even want to keep going.
Yeah,
we have the rivalry that caused the deadliest crash in motorsport history.
Ooh.
We have the history of horns and some weird variations thereon. We have
a train horn
Operation
just went outside.
Incredible Sport.
Is that some sort of like
timely.
Serendipity
that
shit?
That was timely. Yes. Mm. Operation Acoustic Kitty, I think, is also in here somewhere. Porsche family cars.
Needless to say, there's a lot of stuff we're going to start doing. We're going to do them more often.
Yes.
We're going to buckle down. We have a little bit more time now that we're doing the episodes at home. I don't have to spend hours in the car. So we're going to put a little bit more effort into the Drivers Club with the exclusive content. If you want to sign up, it's overcrestproductions.com/driveclub will allow you access to the Drivers Club.
And this month, hear about the fastest cyclist in the world with a Porsche 935.
Yes, absolutely. All right, let's get into our interview.
Mr. Randy Cannon, thanks for joining us.
Glad to be here, guys. Thanks very much.
So as you heard, we did a whole episode last week where I kind of gave, I guess I'll call it a cursory overview of motorsports and kind of the failure that were the racetracks in Vegas.
Indeed.
And I kept coming across your name, Randall Cannon, Randy Cannon. You apparently are the expert on all things Vegas and motorsport and the tie-in there, and the author of two books that I just mentioned previously this and that we'll link to in the show notes, of course, as well.
So my question is, are you in the mob? Because if you seem pretty plugged in.
I could tell you, but then no.
Yeah, there you go.
But I've met some very interesting people, and I've certainly upset some very interesting people.
Okay. I'm excited to dig into it. I think before we do that, I want to get a little background on yourself, because you grew up in the Vegas area, and I want to know what was it like at the time. Like, paint us a picture of it and what that experience was.
It was the scrappy desert Southwest, a population of somewhere between 5 and 10% of what modern Las Vegas is now. We're hovering around probably 2.2 million people in the valley now. And it was my family moved here in the early 60s, probably 50,000 then. And when I moved away in 84, before returning back years later, there were probably about 200,000 people. The populated area of Las Vegas did not reach out to McCarran Airport, if you guys know where that is now. Now the valley has completely engulfed McCarran Airport. The populated landmass is, I guess tenfold, pretty much out to the mountain perimeter of the Las Vegas Valley. Sagebrush, desert tortoises, rattlesnakes. I think I wrote in Stardust where the track was developed. These were all Jeep trails, and you didn't. If you headed out there, take water with you, because you're not going to find anything but trouble. It was a very, very different valley. I growing up here, it was hot, it was dusty. The town existed for one reason, and that was to support this, you know, this Glitter Gulch, this gambling mecca, even though it was tiny at the time.
Yeah, the Vice and City.
Fairly early in my time here, my family started hearing about this racetrack that was going to be built over on the western plateau of the valley. And it's interesting, it wasn't that far away from where Caesar's Palace is right now. It was 6 miles due west of where Caesar's Palace is. But there was nothing for miles, nothing. If you went a few hundred yards west of the strip, it's desert in this mid-1960s era. There was very little to do here. We rode bicycles, we raced motorcycles, and we brought desert tortoises home and kept them as pets. That's what life was like in the 1960s.
So when did you first go to the Stardust track? And so first of all, what year was that built? You know, you mentioned that you had heard about it being built, so you probably saw kind of the construction.
It was built in 1965. Interestingly, in the early 60s, the Department of Justice had authorized FBI wiretaps into a number of the resorts here, the Stardust being one of them. And as I dug into FBI transcripts, the Stardust Raceway was mentioned a couple of years before it was actually being built. These developers, who were very close to the ownership of the Stardust that was supported by the Chicago outfit, they were talking about this piece of property that would become the racetrack.
Describe to me the Chicago outfit. What do you mean by that?
The Chicago outfit is the Chicago function of the mafia, the larger mob, and organized crime. There's a Chicago outfit. There was a Cleveland group. There was a Miami group. Obviously, a large New York group. But the Chicago outfit was very close with the Teamsters. I mean, you guys mentioned the Teamsters loans that underwrote the development of the Stardust. And the Chicago outfit, they indeed held the purse strings of the Stardust Hotel and Casino.
How does that relationship function? Like, what is that, like the money, like how, you know, how do they do it from Chicago? Because I think of the movie Casino, where the dudes from Florida are constantly calling Sam Rothstein to make sure everything's going okay. Like, is that a pretty accurate representation of how this works? Or how does that relationship come to be? Or how did it come to be? And then how does it evolve into, you know, racetrack and underwriting loans and stuff like that?
You know, it's really interesting, fascinating actually. And you mentioned Casino. The book Casino is actually a true story using real names. And the Sam Rothstein character was actually Frank Rosenthal. And he was put here stationed at the Stardust by way of the Chicago outfit. He was here in that time period to look after their interests at the Stardust. The Joe Pesci character was in real life was Anthony Spilotro. He was a made member of the mafia. There was kind of a coalition at the time of Chicago elements and Kansas City elements. And some of those phone calls that you see in the movie where the phone call comes from the pizzeria and what's going on in Vegas. And that was a Kansas City pizzeria. It was a real pizzeria. And that's what led to their whole undoing, where those phone calls were tapped. But it's basically the mob, whichever group it was that was the primary host, if you will, of a particular resort. They'd have a somewhat sanitized ownership group that could exist and be licensed on paper by the Nevada Gaming Commission. And then there would be hidden interests. And those hidden interests, these hidden people, they would basically own the points of the people who could be licensed. A piece of property like the Stardust, it was never really intended to be about racing. It was kind of probably a bit of a lark. Let's see if we can just throw a scrappy track out there and see if we can get people to come to races and get them to the casino. And until we're ready to do something else with that property, well, that's what we'll do with it. But oftentimes these desert Southwest big blocks of property were used to transact these hidden points in the resorts. Maybe somebody who's sanitized would buy a piece of property for $100,000 one day, and the next day this guy who cannot appear on any public records in this casino, you'll buy it from me for $200,000 or $500,000. Mm. And that difference between purchase price and sale price, that'll be your investment in this resort. And so these pieces of property kind of they became placeholders on this secret ledger of this, you know, large national organized crime network. They just used the dirt to do their deals. And anybody can own a piece of dirt, but only a select group of people can invest in a Las Vegas casino then and now.
Right, because you had to be on the up and up. You had to be approved by the Gaming Commission.
Up and up, that, enough.
Yeah, there was enough.
Up and like, up, enough. Okay.
As long as Joe Pesci isn't beating you to death with a phone, you're probably fine. You know.
They did a pretty good job Joe Pesci's character did a pretty good job capturing the violence of the real Anthony Spilotro.
Was it really that violent then in Vegas? Like
it was pretty violent. Growing up here, my family here, the violence would never have been directed toward us. But for the gamblers in the casinos, if someone didn't pay their pay off their marker, it became violent. If there was strife within the organized crime elements themselves, it became very violent. That's how they resolved issues.
And was that widely known in the community?
It was fairly widely known in the community in the time period, the 60s and 70s. The unions were corrupt, the trade unions, most of the positions that someone might have in a casino, hotel casino, those would be union represented positions. So everybody would hear the stories. Everybody would tell the stories. Most people knew someone working at a resort who might wind up in the headlines later, or if they worked there, they were supervised by someone who would wind up in the headlines later. It was the movie Casino did a pretty good job of depicting it.
Is that the best gangster movie of all time, in your opinion?
Pretty dang good gangster movie.
Yeah.
I never got clear on the background of why in the movie the names and even the resort itself, it was called the Tangiers in the movie. Yeah. In the book, it's the Stardust, and the real names are used in the book. I didn't know why
you can't do that in the movie. Somebody's going to get sued. You know, that's
I suppose
much,
so.
Pretty much I suppose what it comes so. Down to. So how do you go from, all right, we're going to put this like muckety muck track outside the Stardust that will maybe people will drive around on it, come and play some mechanical slot machines, you know, putting the string in, pulling the quarter back out, whatever people do.
There you go.
That would get you in trouble with said mobsters. I'm pretty sure.
That's probably true.
And said violence might ensue.
Yeah, exactly. Said violence. How do you go from that to, hey, maybe we should do a Formula One circuit? Because that's, we go from,
well,
like backwoods Stardust to like international motorsport. That's a big difference.
Yeah, I think you're jumping ahead though, Chris, because Stardust in its own right, at least from what I remember reading, like it wasn't a terrible track.
It was a very competitive, very high speed track. It was flat. It had no real reference points on it. There were no trees. There was no landscaping. There really weren't many buildings. There weren't many facilities there, but it was a wide, very racy track, much like Caesar's Palace Grand Prix. You could sit in the stands and see the whole track. So from that standpoint, I loved it. And I think you guys mentioned the Can-Am series. That was the pinnacle of American motorsport for a lot of people in the mid to late 60s. And that was an international field. Bruce McLaren, Denny Hulme, who was a Formula One champion, Jackie Stewart, who would become a Formula One champion. All those guys are racing in the Can-Am series. It was fascinating.
So you actually were able to attend some of those races, right?
I did. I attended, there were, the NI, I'm going to shift gears figuratively. The NHRA was in a very different period of its growth curve at the time. There were only four NHRA national events at the time. Now there's, 25, 30 nationals?
A lot of them,
yeah. And so they had this other type of racing called National Open. And it was slightly a B league. That's not fair to it. It was not a national, but it brought all of the stars. And so I got to attend the 1967 and 68 National Open events. And then I also got to attend the 1968 Can-Am event. It was the championship decider. It was the race at which Jim Hall famously flipped his white high-wing Chaparral and ended his sports racing career. Stories are told to this day about that crash. But I got to see Can-Am in its heyday, and they were indelible memories. My colleague on the Stardust book, Mike Gary, he went to the early 1968 USAC Champ Car race. The National Championship Trail was the Indy 500 was the pivotal event of that National Championship Trail. So these were extremely nationally and internationally prominent events in a relatively small population center at the time. It was really quite something.
Yeah, and you know, going to those races, it must have impacted you in some way to go on now years later to write these books. I mean, were you always interested in motorsport? Are you a self-proclaimed car guy, or did you come from that family at all?
Well, it's probably trite, but what 12-year-old wasn't a car kid at some point? You know, we had our hopped up Stingray bicycles, and I said we raced motorcycles. That's my extent of motorsports, direct motorsports involvement. But yeah, I always enjoyed motorsports, and that was my where I saw it up close and personal in some of its glory years for what was racing at the time. And carried those memories with me. I hung on to the magazines. I hung on to the race programs. Anything that I could carry along with me to remember those golden years, I did. And they eventually turned into a book, and where I could mix my memories into that manuscript, the Stardust manuscript and the Caesars manuscript, I did. I was there on the ground, so thought it was fair to do so.
What prompted you to write these books at this point? Because in reading your bio, I mean, you're not necessarily, you know, you haven't been an author your whole life. This hasn't been necessarily your wheelhouse.
No.
So what prompted this?
My colleague on the Stardust book was in motorsports most of his life, fairly high level drag racing. And he was working on a specific drag racing project. It was kind of a novelty project. And he wanted some help with communications and socials and things like that. I had no background in that, but he's my friend of, you know, by nearly 50 years. He also grew up in the Las Vegas Valley. So I said, yeah, I'll help you. Sure. What the heck, and see what I can do. And it clicked really well. And it kind of brought me back to my Stardust memories of the mid to late 60s. And one day I said, you know, I think I just want to turn this into a book. I'm just going to write the book. There's not more than a few sentences strung together about Stardust International Raceway anywhere. It ain't out there. I'll see if I can write the book and see if anything can come of it. And so I hadn't pitched anything to a publisher. I just thought, I'm going to do the research and the writing and write the book. I had it out to about 200,000 words and started pitching it around to publishers, something else I knew nothing about. And the publisher that picked it up really liked it. They thought, wow, you did something kind of weird here. You've got these two, what seem to be distinct subjects, motorsports and mob, but you synthesized them together and you told the story and you did the research and you supported it. And we kind of like that scholarly approach to telling this weird story. So yeah, what the heck? We'll sign you up. So that's kind of how that happened.
So speaking of the research and doing the digging, this is what I want to hear about, right? What are these conversations like, or what did you stumble upon doing this research for both the Stardust book and the Caesars Palace Grand Prix? You know, it had to be interesting going down these rabbit holes.
Fascinating. I didn't know what I was getting into. The two or three sentences that you could find in any other published work said something to the effect that the Stardust Raceway was constructed by and owned by the Stardust Hotel. That's not a completely honest answer, and it's not a fair answer. And so I thought, I'm going to find out who literally owned that dirt. And so I dug into that one square mile piece of property.
Digging up dirt on somebody. Literally. Digging up dirt. Yeah.
And so I uh, I looked at every, I found every periodical I could find. That was probably the easy part, newspaper accounts. But the property records themselves, like I alluded to earlier, who really put their name on the dirt? And that's where the story really started to come together. And I think you guys mentioned in your last episode the name Mo Dalis. And so he's the primary owner of the Stardust Hotel and Casino, that corporation at that time. And he's also the primary owner of this entity called the Stardust Racing Association. And he's got a few of his Stardust people in here. There's a few other people, but it's this completely separately capitalized corporation. And the dirt was owned by other property development colleagues of his, kind of that proverbial sanitized group of people over here. They're from Cleveland. They've done deals with Mo Dalis, but they're otherwise out of the gaming industry. They're clean over here. And so they first acquired the dirt. And then Mo kind of commissioned the racetrack. They built it for Mo's Stardust Racing Association. And then later it became an asset. A couple of years later, it became an asset of the Stardust Hotel and Casino at about the time that Howard Hughes was trying to buy the Stardust Hotel and Casino, which was another interesting tangent. But it was by way of digging into, like you said, Chris, digging into the dirt to dig up the dirt. I found that. And then once I was able to connect the name Mo Dalis, one of the most well-known racketeers to ever come from back east out to Las Vegas and put drive his
what is racketeer? What is racketeering? You know, you hear that term a lot, but I don't know exactly what it is.
Racketeer is basically real simple terms, white collar crime. It's white collar crime involving corporation or corporations, and it is the origin of the RICO statute. That is a federal law, racketeer influenced corrupt organization. The federal government, the Department of Justice, they oftentimes prosecute people under the RICO statute. You didn't kill anyone, you didn't directly steal things, but you've got this corrupt organization going on, and you're not paying taxes, and so we're going to throw RICO at you. Okay. And so it's the racketeers were the people doing kind of mob adjacent people doing shady deals, not paying taxes on money.
Do you have any examples like what was going on in Vegas with this particular guy that you're talking about? Just like, this is what was going on. This is the racketeering that was taking place. Like, I'm still having trouble. Like, what crime, when you say white collar crime, like, what are we doing? Are we talking about taking the points off of gambling and then pocketing it and never telling anybody, or trading it for Rolexes and race cars, or what are we talking about exactly?
Maybe all of the above. Researching Stardust, one of the things that I found in the research was a pretty common racketeering ruse is to they'll skim money out of a casino property. They'll send this untaxed money to an offshore banking corporation that maybe they capitalized in the first place. Then they'll start another business. They'll take loans out of this offshore enterprise, and they will not repay those loans. And they will then bankrupt that corporation, and thereby they laundered that money. Right. That's a pretty common racketeering exercise, and it was very well documented in Las Vegas and nationally and globally in the time period. And as I fast forward 50, 60 years, I wonder how differently things really are now. They're about offshore accounts and racketeering and RICO. All the time, to the highest offices of the land.
Mm-hmm. I want to circle back in that to kind of where we are today, but I want to keep on track with, you know, Mo Dalis and his involvement there, and really how, once the track was set up, what was the involvement there? You know, I remember reading something, it might have been an excerpt from the book, about drivers coming out and saying, you know, I know the track's good, what goes on, and the owners, I want to not know, basically. I'm paraphrasing.
That's pretty much it. When I interviewed the late Bobby Unser about the Stardust book, he said, "Yeah, Randy, I knew all about those owners of Stardust, but I don't really want to talk about it." And they did. There was this, you know, wink, wink, nod, nod, elbow, elbow. They knew who they were. They knew they were Desert Southwest racketeers at the time, and shady people, and connected to Chicago and Kansas City and Lord knows where else. But it's a racetrack, and these guys are under contract to show up on Saturday and Sunday and be competitive and win races and support their sponsors. So, Mario Andretti raced at Stardust, and he pretty much said the same thing. Hey, I'm driving for an owner. Just tell me where to show up, and I'm going to drive that car as fast as I can. I don't care who owns the track. I don't.
So, do you know? I was just going to ask Chris, did the mob ever get involved in the actual racing? We know they were involved in the track, and that was kind of their whole...
You're asking, did they feel the car? Do they have a car that they sponsored? Or
well, not even
like
get
that,
into fielding a car, but I don't know. I'm thinking about all the gambling that goes on in Vegas, and you hear about maybe mobsters paying people off to throw a fight or something to that effect. Did that ever happen on the racetrack? Mm. Were they ever involved in the actual racing in any way that you found out?
I couldn't find instances of anybody being paid to take a dive on the racetrack. You mentioned in your last episode, you mentioned the old horse track that the National Championship Trail held its final round of the 1954 season. One of the national speed sport news writers of the time, Jep Kadu, he wrote this scathing op-ed about the folly of racing in Vegas, where all of these gamblers are going to be there at the track, and they're obviously going to be trying to get drivers to take a dive and influence the betting. There were no documented instances of that. Jep said, if any gambler shows up in the pits and tries to put some money in somebody's face, I hope the mechanic takes a wrench and clobbers him. You know, tools of the trade sort of thing. Back at you, buddy. But in the Can-Am era, I think it was National Speed Sport News. They tried to find out if there was any betting going on, proverbial off-track betting. And they called one of the prominent sports books here and said, what are the odds for the Can-Am race this Sunday? Can-Am race, what's that? Well, it's a big motorsports event. Yeah, we don't take any action on auto races. Hmm. That's kind of how it was at the time.
Why was that? There just wasn't the interest in it, or was it something like they needed to have a hands-off approach?
I think it was more they didn't know how to engage gambling with motorsports yet. Fast forward to now, and there's betting action on every motorsport, every professional motorsports event every weekend, right here, including right here in the Valley. By the time of the Caesars Palace Grand Prix, casinos were taking action on the Caesars Palace Grand Prix. But in the 60s, I couldn't find any evidence of it whatsoever. Gentlemen's bets in the pits, probably, cash money bets in the pits, probably. But couldn't find any organized, institutionalized betting action back then.
Yeah. So I do want to fast forward into Caesars Palace Grand Prix, because that's where things really got dicey, I guess, from what I saw. Real quick, whatever happened to the Stardust track? I mean, it seemed like it was successful for what it was at, and then I didn't find much about why it closed.
It in 1968, the property was transitioned to an asset of the Stardust Hotel and Casino. The Stardust Hotel and Casino, along with a couple of other properties in the same ownership, were sold, and then that property was spun off for property development. And it literally is it's part of 1980s. Constructed suburbia now. There's not a single vestige of that track left. At some point, Mo Dalitz and his buddies, they just decided we've experimented with this land enough to the extent it might have been a secret ledger for other casino ownership deals we had cooking, other things going on. It is spun out, and we're just going to cast it off and sell it to a developer. Not a lot more to it than that. The property developer had some interesting connections to the Chicago outfit, but I couldn't get the trail to work for me more than that. One of the partners in the development company was had at least an elbow distance relationship with a really prominent member of the Chicago outfit. but hard to dig further when the records just don't exist.
All right, so fast forward to 1980, or I suppose the years leading up to that, you know, it was Watkins Glen basically was going into bankruptcy. We needed somewhere to host an F1 race. At least that's how I kind of had approached what had happened there. How does Caesar Palace and the owners come to the idea that, yeah, we're gonna put it up here. We're going to create a parking lot racetrack?
It's an interesting story. I should mention I'm wearing my my period correct Caesar's Palace Grand Prix long sleeve.
That's the shirt I wanted. I don't know if you remember. I think I mentioned something about I saw like all these vintage shirts. Oh, that's awesome.
I wouldn't have worn it if you hadn't mentioned it.
I love that. Oh, that's amazing. Pretty good. Were you actually there?
I attended the 81 and 82 events and the 83 IndyCar event.
Okay.
Got to wear the gear.
So start from the beginning then on Caesar's Palace. How did this come about? And first of all, I didn't even ask you this. How factually inaccurate was my episode? I always like to ask the experts after the fact. Where do I need corrections?
Just telling me he's wrong a lot.
You really broad brush strokes. You did okay.
That's all I was planning for. All right. I appreciate that.
Go to the index. Well, Meyer Lansky's mentioned 56 times, so bam, it's a Meyer Lansky joint. Not bad. I'll try to encapsulate it. Caesars was developed with it was as mobbed up in its inception as the Stardust Hotel and Casino was. You mentioned the movie Casino a couple of times. That was the Stardust, mm-hmm. completely mobbed up. And that was the origin of Caesar's Palace. Caesar's Palace opened only 8 years after the Stardust opened. It originated with a mortgage from the Teamsters Central States Pension Fund. Jimmy Hoffa was at the grand opening, and all of the mob was invested in Caesar's Palace, typically by way of, you know, a proxy would hold my stake in the casino. But you know, this person who cannot be licensed is the actual owner of the points. In 1969, the first ownership of the casino sold to a second ownership, which was a corporation, and this was after the inception of the Nevada corporate gaming law. Previously, a coalition of individuals would own a casino, and in the late 60s, it became legal in Nevada for a corporation to own a casino, and only those people owning more than 5% had to be investigated and licensed. Huh. But Cliff and this corporation was led by Cliff Perlman. If you guys have seen The Irishman, toward the end of the movie, that Joe Pesci character is one of his favorite joints is Lum's Hot Dogs. He's on a collections run to I think somewhere in Pennsylvania. Hey, pull over here, and they pull over in front of a Lum's Hot Dogs. That was his favorite joint. And what was that character's name? Russell Buffalino. But that was Cliff Perlman and his brother Stuart Perlman. They were the Lum's guys, and so they were very very well known to the crime families of the time. So Lum's buys Caesar's Palace, and it's the stuff of legend. A few Securities and Exchange Commission investigations. It never really got cleaned up while Cliff Perlman was in the CEO seat.
It's interesting how much easier it must have been to get away with things back then, because right now everything's digital and it's very hard.
Indeed.
Back then you could just chuck shit in the fire.
Indeed.
Like just throw it in the fire. It's gone. It's done. That's it.
Yeah. If it didn't exist on paper, it didn't exist.
It didn't exist. Prove it. No. Come on, man. Prove it.
Cliff Perlman and the people that he hired, They were trying to shed the Teamsters mortgage. They were trying to get more straightforward institutional financing. He was also trying to kind of create what sort of modern Las Vegas is like tonight. These resorts as experiential entertainment. He's trying to bring sporting events to the Caesars Palace campus. And one of my interviews was one of the people he hired, a guy named Bill Weinberger. Bill's probably 81, 82 now. He was hired when he was 39 years old by Cliff Perlman. He became the vice president of casino marketing. And his job was to come up with all the cool ideas. And he had gone to He and his supervisor had gone to Monaco, seen the Monaco Grand Prix. And it was no more involved than that. Do you think we could do something like this to involve Caesar's Las Vegas and Caesar's Palace? And this was in roughly 1970. This was about 1977. First Caesar's Grand Prix wasn't until 4 years later. The Long Beach Grand Prix was also coming to exist in that same time period. The first Formula One Grand Prix in Long Beach was 76. So this is directly corollary to that. And so Bill Weinberger just went on this quest. How do I go about creating a Grand Prix? And he was told to call Bernie Ecclestone, call the Sports Car Club of America. They would have been the domestic American sanctioning body for Formula One. And so he started making these phone calls and started trying to figure out what he could do.
Can you just start adding "or else" to everything you say? Like, yeah, he was looking for the guy from the SCCA club, or else.
Yeah.
Imagining there's just "or else."
I want to make him an offer he can't refuse.
Yeah, just add "or else" to everything. It seems like that's gotta be how it goes.
Bill's a pretty straightforward guy. His father was an original investor in Caesar's Palace. He certainly knows the stories. Him as a second generation person involved in Caesars, he was trying to create a different landscape. He was trying to make Caesars much more institutional as a respected corporation. You mentioned Jerome Zarowitz. I was shocked that name came up in your last episode. Bill Weinberger is trying to take Caesars this way. Jerome Zarowitz is just determined to keep it going the other way and keep the money flowing back to Chicago and New York and Miami. But it was in this time period. Cliff Perlman's in the midst of all these investigations, as is Caesars. There's all kinds of crazy things going on. Bill keeps his head to his nose to the grindstone, and he's trying to hatch a Grand Prix. He didn't know anything about Stardust International Raceway. He just knew Formula One is a thing. Can we bring it to Las Vegas and Caesars Palace? And in 1980, there was actually supposed to be a Grand Prix, and that was the last year of Formula One at Watkins Glen, if I have my history correct. No, there was an 81 event. For a time, it was Watkins Glen, at least in the headlines, Watkins Glen in Las Vegas like this. Las Vegas is going to kill the U.S. Grand Prix at Watkins Glen. Long Beach is kind of over here. The people who were involved in Long Beach weren't real excited about it. And so Bill Weinberger had a stroke of genius one day, and he said, once he got things going for the 81 event, he literally hired the organizer of the Long Beach Grand Prix to organize the Caesars Palace Grand Prix. All of the everything to do with the race, logistics, basic sponsorship drives, all of the organization, he hired someone who had already done it, Chris Pook from the Long Beach Grand Prix Corporation, which was a kind of an interesting dynamic. And in 81, it's for real. Yeah, it can't occur on the strip. The strip was still a federal highway at the time. It was U.S. Route 91. And so that was never going to happen, although that was part of the original plan. But we're going to race right in front of Caesar's Palace down the strip and then turn back into the property.
So my question, I'm going to just pause you right there, Randy. Was that proposed to Formula One as like, because how do you get them to agree to come to Vegas, right? When they know full well you don't have a track. And yes, the precedent's been set for, you know, road courses and street courses. So was the expectation that, yes, we're going to shut down streets and we're going to race like this and this is what the track will be?
In 1980, that was Bernie Ecclestone's expectation. We're going to race down the strip. Above all, he wanted to race in Las Vegas. Bernie was a hell of a gambler himself. He loved the vibe. He's in his 90s now. I think he still comes to Las Vegas to throw down. But he was trying to grow Formula One to race in the destination cities of the globe. Mm-hmm. And Las Vegas was one of his favorites. And it had, like Monaco, it had legalized gambling. So that was his thing. By 1981, they had to kind of settle it out. We're gonna race on the property itself. We're not going out on the strip. It's like turn one was like 50 yards from the strip, but you guys have seen the track. I think someone described it as this weird looking intestinal tract or something like that.
Yeah.
And yeah, it was weird.
It doesn't look great. Doesn't look like a lot of fun.
No, didn't look great. And It was surrounded by parking lot and by gravel. It was a purpose-built Formula One track. It had to comply with FIA specifications. They cut down through the existing parking lot and built this deep section asphalt that Formula One cars could race on without rippling the asphalt. Interestingly, the northern half of the track was on former Howard Hughes Tool Company property. Caesars leased that property from the Hughes Tool Company so that they had enough acreage to build enough mileage for the circuit.
So was there a lot of build up to this, to the first event? So they build a track. Is there like a bunch of hype going on about this?
I don't remember radio sounders about it, but I definitely knew about the event. Like you alluded to, media was so different at the time. There wouldn't have been much word of mouth. The Las Vegas Grand Prix for 2023, by contrast, it's hugely being driven by social media and streaming programming, and that just didn't exist at the time.
Sure.
It was largely, maybe there was some radio, maybe there was some television. Predominantly, it was going to be advertising and newsprint. And that's probably where I first saw it, was in the newspaper.
Was there any relationships between any of the drivers and the mob at all for this track and these events? Was there any guys that were kind of, you know, they'd leave the track and, you imagine the guy maybe going over the casino and they're like, "Hey dude, how's it going? You want an extra stack of chips? Come over here." Anything?
I wish I could say there was, but I couldn't find any evidence of that. There was some of the drivers gambled in the Caesars property, before the event, but the interesting thing that I learned about organized crime is it seems like organized crime, by way of movies like Godfather, Casino, et cetera, there, it's kind of an in-your-face sort of presence, but the way they do their true business, their core business, it's much more subtle, and it was even much more subtle at the time. They don't want to get caught. They don't want their secret relationships to become exposed, and they didn't want to lose that skim from the casino cages, which did exist into the 80s. If somebody owned a percentage of the corporation that owned Caesar's Palace, even into the 80s, they were probably still getting their percentage of the skim. The timeline setting of the movie Casino is the mid to late 1970s, not much earlier than the Caesar's Palace Grand Prix.
So you were at the 81 Grand Prix at Caesar's Palace, and I'm curious if, looking back, we have kind of this expectation for what a Grand Prix track should be, and we see the big venues that Formula One, is at and has been at, and so it was comical looking back at what this track was. But I'm curious, at the time, did it seem ridiculous? Did it seem kind of, underwhelming? Or what was your impression?
As a fan, as a spectator, I thought it was pretty good racing. My only gripe was that there was no landscaping. That there just was no greenery. My exposure to Formula One at that point would have been what I would have seen in like Road and Track's coverage of the U.S. Grand Prix, and there would be tree-lined straightaways. I'd see the grassy infield. I'd see pictures of the bog where they're burning automobiles and things like that. And Caesar's Palace Grand Prix, it was paving asphalt with the track cut into it. And then on the former Howard Hughes property, it's gravel. I can go outside my house and see gravel. And so that was interesting. And it was, the 81 event was in November. The 82 event was in September. And right. And both events, the winds gusted from time to time, and it would blow sand across the track from the gravel properties, and it was not real pleasant in that regard. Especially back then, when the wind blew in Vegas, oh my gosh. But the racing itself, the facilities, the relationship of the casino and the hotel to the track itself. I thought all of that was as well done as that could have been. I thought it was pretty cool. It was Formula One in Las Vegas, and even at my young age then, I was a fan, and I thought it was fantastic.
Yeah. What was the most maybe interesting thing? Was there anything surprising doing this research about this event in particular in the Caesar's Palace?
In particular, is there anything that you read that you wish you wouldn't have? any knowledge that you learn that you're like, oh, maybe that would have been left unsaid would be better.
I did head into some rabbit holes that I wish I hadn't. Much of it made it into the book. I felt like I really, really had to explain Cliff Perlman to demonstrate this thesis of Las Vegas organized crime and the pinnacle of motorsport. And Cliff Perlman was kind of one of organized crime's kind of sleeper racketeers. They, you know, he was alleged to have been originally put in business in the Lums hot dog chain by Meyer Lansky. Meyer Lansky was at the time was kind of the presumed number two in this larger national organized crime syndicate. Think Beyond Mafia, this coalition of all the ethnic gangs together running more than we want to think about America at the time. And Cliff Perlman he's doing deals with this fellow named Alvin Melnick. He's kind of pushing through a Caesar's World deal with this fellow named Alvin Melnick. And he also did a personal deal with Alvin Melnick while Cliff Perlman is a licensed employee owner of Caesar's World, the parent corporation of Caesar's Palace. Alvin Melnick to the FBI, he's the presumed number two to Meyer Lansky. One of the deals was the sale of the Caesars Pocono honeymoon resorts, these branded resorts back in Pennsylvania. They sold them to Alvin Melnick. Those banners are on those 3 foot high concrete barriers that define the track at the Caesars Palace Grand Prix. And there's this image of Cliff Perlman on the podium during the podium celebration. I thought you kind of have it all right there. Cliff Perlman's connected. He's connected to Alvin Melnick, this FBI report, presumed number two to Meyer Lansky, and those banners, those innocuous banners for Caesars Pocono Resorts, Alvin Melnick owns that property. And yeah, as you guys said in the last episode, the events did not churn a lot of spectatorship, no big, huge media deals. They didn't churn a lot of dollars for the Caesars Casino. There was probably... Alvin Melnick nor Meyer Lansky probably had a direct tap on the till of the Caesars Palace Grand Prix. No, but there's all these people that are at least Grand Prix adjacent that, wow, I would have never thought that. How does that work? And Cliff Perlman, did you really need to go up there on the podium while you're in the midst of all these investigations? Yes, he did.
Yeah,
he did it.
You know, you alluded a little bit to some of this may still be going on. And I think it's interesting as we are going into the 2023 season and Formula One's coming back to Vegas, you know, that's what kind of led me down this road in the first place. Is the mob still in Vegas? What connections are still there? What are you thinking is happening?
It probably depends on what one's definition of the mob is and how we feel about, is there such a thing as the mob, or at least a few conspiracy theories may be true? You know,
The mob is just the government now. Let's be honest.
What Chris said. I do think there's racketeering in corporate America. I think it's rife with racketeering. Mm-hmm. I think the easy to point to Sicilian Italian mafia function of the mob, the larger mob in the post-depression era, the post-bootlegging era, I think that's probably a minority stake in the bad things that happen. But I wonder if the Islamic monarchy of Saudi Arabia, of them making an overture to buy Formula One, is that where the real call it mob? If that's where the real racketeering is going on, as Saudi Arabia tries to control more and more of more and more American business and invest more and more in American foundational underpinnings, I think that's a study unto itself. It's not an easy answer, but Saudi Arabia and LIV Golf creeps me out, and Saudi Arabia trying to buy Formula One creeps me out. And
So what you're saying is nobody's putting anybody's head in a vice anymore.
Probably not. At least not until their eyeballs pop out.
Yeah.
In Saudi Arabia, they dispense with the vice altogether.
Yeah, they just skip the whole thing. Rather than pop your head off, they just cut it off.
Yeah, there you go.
Well, yeah. True. Randy, thank you so much. Lastly, where can people find out more about you and purchase your books?
Three good go-tos. You can always find it on Amazon. Search my name, Randall Cannon, or either of the titles, Stardust International Raceway, Caesars Palace Grand Prix. I always like to point people to Autobooks, arrowbooks.com. They're down in Burbank, a real true mom and pop bookstore. A heck of a place. They're really nice people. I think they might still have some signed copies. And you can always get it from the publisher, McFarland Company Publishing. Those are three good go-tos. Always easy on Amazon. They've always got copies available.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much. It's been illuminating and very cool to hear from who I kept stumbling across in my research as the expert. So this has been awesome. Thank you, Randy.
Thank you, guys. Pleasure to be here. And can't wait to hear the show.
Take care. Yeah. Bye.